We're supposed to start at 10:20. This was our problem. Our problem in the morning was we started late. I take some responsibility for that, but some people seem to think it started at 8:30 and got late. So anyway, we're on schedule now. We're going to start at 10:20. So let's get going. Just one change in the schedule. Richard Hooper was to be speaking from the Qatar Petroleum Company. He is unable to attend, and Penny Price will present in his absence. So we have the same number that are on the list there, just to substitute. I'd like to introduce our framing speaker, who has 20 minutes. Kevin Dugan is here from the University of Bristol, UK. His research interests include job insecurity in the new economy, mobility, flexibility, and industrial relations, something slightly familiar to my world. His book, The New Capitalism, it has quite a description to it, but we're going to get another view, and I think perhaps a complementary view of globalization and the new world order, if we like. So I'll turn it over to Kevin Dugan.
Thanks very much. Part of the task for the audience is to try and go through the different levels of discussion from the macro to the micro and soar up and down, you know, as the different topics demand. Mine and the following speaker is going to be much, much more macro level discussion, and leaving to the innovators the a more workplace specific discussion. So, like the first speaker today, I'm who talks about Greenspan's conversion on the road to Damascus when it came to neoliberalism. There's any number of people we can quote if we want to reflect the ideological or intellectual crisis that has attended the economic crisis. So just to chip in, Larry Summers, chief economic advisor to President Obama, former president of Harvard, last year stated that whole swathes of economics needs to be rethought as a consequence of the global financial meltdown. There are others going around. Greenspan's already been mentioned. George Soros talked about the crisis being a game-changing event. And it was very exciting to capture these wonderful quotes in the period after Lehman collapsed and in the months following. But what is interesting is, if you like, not only a financial stabilization, there's some kind of almost ideological restabilization taking place as well. One of the more astute commentators in the Financial Times talked about how faith in efficient markets had collapsed, but people are still going to the same church. In other words, there's no alternative, if you like, economic model out there to replace what has happened. And so there's no global solution to what caused the crisis. And so the, if you like, ideological intellectual confusion continues. And I thought it was really interesting that the Financial Times last week talked about, and this is a year after, just over a year after the Lehman Brothers, the possible resurgence of a property market boom in London based upon commercial real estate. People's memories are quite short-lived if that's a realistic possibility. So the rhetoric of, and people like myself will use these quotes to argue for rethink and review of policies and questioning models, and questioning the basic neoliberal kind of way of understanding the world, but also at the same time realize that the policy pendulum shifts both ways. that way and then back. So in terms of this rethink, I want to explore health and economic convergence, and I would suggest that we need to rethink the relationship between work and welfare. First of all, with work and welfare, across the world, words like social security and welfare connote different senses, different meanings. Social security in the United States is a very different concept to social security in the UK, similarly with welfare. When I'm talking about welfare, I'm talking about a more broadly embracing sphere or domain encompassing health, social care, education, and so forth. And in the rethink and review of the nature and the relationship between work and welfare, I'm suggesting that the understanding of the nature and functions of the labour market is central to that. So that's why I've been left with this, been given this rather prosaic title, How the Labour Market Works. Curious thing about markets, people don't talk about them much. Coase, the Nobel Prize winning economist, said there's a curious feature of economics that the central institution or mechanism of the economy, the market, is little discussed. It's got this chameleon-like capacity to avoid scrutiny and analysis. So I think we need to look at the labour market and question some of, of the common sense assumptions about it and how it works. There's this idea that labour market is purely as some kind of repository of technological change, globalization, economic restructuring, and institutional restructuring. If you like, it passively responds, and all economists will talk about supply and demand adjustments, finding optimal levels and balancing out and equilibrium levels and so forth. This cipher model, if you like, of a labor market in which the real world of business and commerce, if you like, the realm of production provides the economic imperatives that drive labour market change. I want to suggest that welfare is not confined to some realm of public altruism in which we, the better off members of society, look after the less fortunate, the poor and the poorly, and suggest that welfare is central to the functioning and maintenance and reproduction of capitalism. More, not only that, welfare states are allied to the purposes of capital accumulation. It was quite interesting in the case studies we mentioned this morning that the benefits of the policies that they're promoting were discussed in terms of absenteeism, job turnover, stability, and so forth. And that is absolutely accurate and appropriate to the benefits that corporations see in social policies. It's also important to recognize that only a minority of the labor force is engaged with the immediate needs of production. A large component of labor power is allocated to its own welfare and reproduction. In the advanced economies, there are more people employed in education and health services than in manufacturing. So this idea of a productionist understanding of labour markets needs to be really challenged. Not only that, many of you will come across the term the flexible labour market, and which is supported by models of the flexible firm. Well, actually, it is welfare provision that has driven changes in the form of employment. Many of the compositional changes, gender composition of employment, and adjustments in employment patterns, full-time or part-time work, are not explained by the rise of the flexible firm, but in fact by the growth of jobs in education, health, and social service provision. In the United States, I mean, we've gone through a period where people talked about the new, waxed lyrical about the new economy, and the Silicon Glen imagery of a high-tech driven revolution and so forth. It's quite interesting that it was health services that made the second largest contribution to job gains during the 80s and early 90s. during the so-called new economy boom. In Europe, it is even more spectacular. Employment growth in health and social services was 10 times greater than the average for the EU economy as a whole. Moreover, in the European Union, while total employment increased by 12.2 million between the 10 years to 2002, health and social services added 6.4 million jobs. That's representing more than one in two additional jobs in the period. I want to suggest, therefore, that far from this productionist understanding of how labour markets work, there are, in fact, two dynamics at work which are productive and reproductive. And these have separate but interrelated dynamics with their own rhythms, planning horizons, their own cast of players, if you like, their own agents at work. They operate, they confer to different patterns, cycles, and different operating conditions. A factory can close, but hospitals can't close with the same ease, the same facility, and with the same sets of costs. We're also told that global competition for foreign direct investment has driven down welfare spending globally. Competition has driven down non-wage labour costs. And in Europe, I'm not sure how familiar people are with the term social dumping, but the idea that competition between national economies leads to a lowering of social standards seems to be the common theme running through a lot of commentaries. But the statistics tell a different story. Aggregate welfare spending has been remarkably resilient over the period throughout the 80s and 90s, when Thatcher and Reagan came to power. People, if you like, on the social democratic left of centre, imagined the end of the welfare state. And but what is interesting, and it's contributions by people like Pearson and Dwayne Swank and so forth, it is remarkable that at aggregate level, welfare spending has held up. So I want to talk about the labour market and the current crisis. And there are, if you like, different elements to the story. There is the good news and the not so good news. But again, in terms of the intellectual and ideological confusion that's around over the last year or so, there was a very interesting article in the Financial Times in April talking about the labour market. And this is a newspaper that has for years and years brought home the message about labour market adaptability, labour market flexibility. The thing that's wrong with labour markets is that they're not sufficiently adaptable to new circumstances. There's too much institutional resistance. And what was really good about the article was that it held up the merits of the rigidity of the labour market, that it wasn't responsive. It didn't cut back. Unemployment didn't go through the roof. Employment didn't collapse. As many of those who would suggest the merits of flexible labour markets might have imagined. And so what was a vice in a previous set of circumstances became a virtue in the new context. But it's part of the way of understanding the labour market as a mechanism, as an institution, that both expresses changing global technological institutional contexts, but is also a mechanism for insulating, for constraining chains. You know, it is an insulator of change as well as a medium through which it takes place. Moving on to the United States. I think it was last week or perhaps the week before when it was acknowledged that unemployment has now gone through the 10% level in the workforce. What is really interesting about this, across the whole of the labour of the major employment groups of the labour market, the only sector of the labour force to expand job creation, the only sector, was healthcare. So there's the figures for you. Total employment in America, United States of America, 136,000.3. A year later, pretty precipitous decline of 6 million. Healthcare, the only sector that has put on jobs, and it's significant that it's put on 300,000. This, if you like, statistically evidences the point I'm making about two dynamics within the labour market, productive and reproductive, with their own cycles, with their own patterns, with their own, you know, if you like, planning timetables. Which leads us to my final slot on the crisis, as to how this might continue to unfold in the period to come. Because it would be difficult to imagine that healthcare employment would continue its recent trajectories ad infinitum, defying financial gravity, if you like. Because despite all the talk of stabilization and the green shoots of recovery and a more positive economic outlook, the cost of financial rescue will impact on welfare spending very, very significantly in the medium to long term. Now, it's very difficult to get a sense of what the rescue, the bailout to the financial services meant. The numbers that are discussed are eye-watering. I mean, you remember when you were kids, you were talked about millions and then billions and then people talked about trillions and then it was squillions and so forth. It's almost as if we're back in that time where there are amounts of money floating out there. And it's almost an act of imagination to get a sense of how much has been spent and laid out in the course of financial rescue. Part of the problem is that states have guaranteed assets. And if you put guarantees into the package of spend, it takes on almost like 29% of total global GDP. A better target and a better estimate, I think, is that of the countries involved in bailout, the fiscal deficit is now about 9% of GDP. So it's a very, very serious, if you like, assault on public spending. And given the importance of direct and indirect public subsidy to health service, it is difficult to imagine that health benefits and services will be unaffected. So in terms of the labour market, when we look at the reproductive dynamics and the trajectories of employment and the job gains, I mean, I think it was summer of last year that health overtook manufacturing in the States as the largest, as an employing sector. And it's grown since that time. It's possible to imagine that medium to long term, a kind of re-establishment of convergence, a re-establishing of trajectories in terms of employment gains, medium to long term, because I think the damage to public finances and the costs of rescue and the bailout of the financial system will be felt with, you know, will felt with governments and welfare state regimes for years and years to come. Some people talk about a generation, you know, of having to live with the debts implied by that. So health and economic convergence, yes, but in far less auspicious circumstances. Leave that with you. Thank you.
Thank you again for that, Kevin.